Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes, playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Election Day, finally here. Don't forget to vote. And then tomorrow, join us for more of WBUR's special coverage of the midterm elections as we break down the results and what they mean for our communities. Today, we start in Worcester, where they are trying to respond to the results of a special audit released in September.
The city of Worcester releasing the racial equity audit report for city government. It looks at a range of issues like hiring and retention processes and how the city approaches public health.
Thanks to Spectrum One News for the sound there. The plan is in place, but now it has to be implemented. And the lessons Worcester is learning along the way could be relevant to every Massachusetts city and town. Joining us now, Eric Batista, acting city manager for Worcester, city councilor Sean Rose, and Ron Waddell, executive director of Legendary Legacies, a nonprofit that mentors young men in Worcester. Eric, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome.
Sean, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Ron, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
So, Eric, as interim city manager, I'm going to start with you. How did we get to an audit in the first place?
Now, it's a good question. The way we got to this audit is there was a lot of community advocacy regarding it came through after the George Floyd murder. And so there was a lot of advocacy to really do an audit on the police department and really look at some of the disparities and marginalization and challenges that oftentimes government is a large system of systemic racism, systemic and institutional racism to look into. And community folks, particularly the Black Families Together coalition here in the city, came together and asked us to conduct racial equity audits. So we went beyond that a little bit. Not only did we do the police department, we also did human resources and health and human services. Two separate consultants doing those, and the one racial equity audit that we recently was able to bring forward to the council and to the public is the Human Resources and Health and Human Services audit. That audit looked at both of those departments. Right now, the police department's racial equity audit is underway, and we're expecting sometime in the summer to have the report for that particular audit.
Sean, city councilor, I'll turn to you and let me just lay out a little bit of what was in the audit. In interviews, for example, employees of color said the city was toxic for diverse hires and suffered from favoritism and nepotism. One of the quotes from the report itself said that, quote, organizational trust and psychological safety are low, end quote. Some employees declined to participate because they feared retaliation for speaking out. Some employees of color felt exploited and stereotyped. Sean, did you expect these kinds of themes, and did you expect them to be this severe when the audit came out?
Honestly, I wasn't really sure what to. My hope was that as people were going through the audit, that they felt vulnerable enough and safe enough to be able to respond in an honest fashion. So I'm appreciative of that, that people felt that comfortable enough to be honest about their opinions about, you know, the policy or practice in the city. When we look at some of the dialogue that came out of it, I think that all of it is very sobering. And I think it just highlights the amount of work that we need to do as a governing body and as a municipality to address these severe and serious concerns.
So, Ron, I'll turn to you here. You work with an organization that supports young men and boys in Worcester. We are hearing that the audit came after protests as a result of the murder of George Floyd. The police audit's still out there. We've also heard from a lot of communities that they wish their cities and towns had responded to concerns about racism, lack of racial equity in those cities and towns long before protests like that were necessary. Has this been a while in the making, and was there anything that came out of the audit that was surprising to you as a resident and community member in Worcester?
First, thanks for allowing me to be on the show with Eric and Sean, and appreciate all the work they've done to get us here. I would say that even the conversation around the audit, it goes back to 2019, if I'm not mistaken, when we lost our first chief diversity officer, when she decided to move on. There were that was when the initial calls from the community were saying that we need to have an audit, as well as the fact that previously to the lynching of George Floyd, the shootings that were going on, Michael Brown, were bringing this to the forefront in conversations here in Worcester. And so, yes, this conversation has been happening in the community and with municipality for a while. When I looked at the report in of itself, I would say that it wasn't surprising to me to see the data in the way it was. I think one of the most concerning was the percentage, which was close to 24% of folks that said that they felt that they could not openly share their opinions without fear or retaliation or punishment. And so kudos to the city for doing the report and in making it public, which is something that has been a cause for concern in the past in respect to transparency. But even as one of the respondents in the audit said, we've done a lot of these reports. We've had similar data available to us. And so now it's about how do we implement that? And to Eric, Sean, and those that are in leadership, they have the work ahead of them. When we look at this report and it says things like resistance to change is ingrained in the culture. And so there's great work to do in regards to shifting culture, not just implementing policies or procedures, but how do we begin to shift the culture? And there's great degree in the report that talks about that I'm excited about.
So, Ron, I'll pick up. According to reporting in the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, three, just to reference for listeners what you were talking about, three chief diversity officers resigned from Worcester. We have one serving 16 months and resigning in 2017, one serving about 26 months, resigning in 2020, and one serving about 15 months and resigning in 2022. And we are speaking with Ron Waddell, Sean Rose, and Eric Batista, all from Worcester, about efforts that Worcester is making to take head on concerns about racial equity, diversity, and inclusion after the results of an equity audit and a plan that's now in place. So, Eric, acting city manager, I'm going to turn back to you. I'm thinking about the time somebody asked Charlie Baker how he was feeling about the rollout of the vaccine website, and he said his hair was on fire about it. Is your hair on fire right now, given what we're hearing and what the plan is and what the needs are?
I wouldn't say my hair's on fire, but I think for me, it's a personal thing as well. I'm a person of color, and I'm the first person of color in this role in the city of Worcester. And so for a person who've gone through certain situations in my lifetime, this becomes also a personal scenario. And that's why for me, I take it with pride and I take it with responsibility to make sure that we do what we can as a city government, as a body, to make change. And, you know, and culture is very important. Setting the tone is very important. So it's not only my responsibility, it will be a responsibility of the city councilor and the mayor and my cabinet members as well, as leaders, to set the culture of what we do. And not just looking at policies and procedures, but actually really looking at the business strategy of city government. Oftentimes, when we put policies and procedures in place, we don't look at the business strategy in itself. And we institute trainings, we try to encourage staff members to make change, et cetera, but we don't give them the tools to make that change, or we don't give them the opportunity or the open door to kind of walk through. So this plan and what I'm going to be leading in the next few months is to try to create that, you know, even just as simply creating a mission and vision around what's our mission as a city, what's our vision, and what are our goals to approach this work, and then continuing that work forward. We're going to rehaul human resources, because we know a lot of those management principles and policies and procedures around staffing, recruitment, hiring, retention, it's all in the human resources, and that's thematic across that racial equity audit. We're going to make changes there. We're going to make changes to the office so, of diversity and inclusion as well.
So I'll stop you there. And thank you, Eric. There's a lot I want to get to in our time. Sean and Ron, I'm going to turn to you together. One elected city councilor, one resident and community leader. Can the city do it? Jump in.
I don't think it's a question about whether we can do it. We have to do it. There's a lot of lip service time and time again about urgency. We're looking at the city trending towards majority, minority, under 55. We have one of the most diverse governing bodies currently, persons of color, non-binary, women. I think that we're trending in a direction where it's not a matter of if we can do it, we have to do it, and there's urgency around it. I think this is personal for the three of us. I, too, am a person of color. I'm the first Black district councilor for my area, my community. I'm raising four daughters, and I ran on the hope and the energy around having this be a place for my four daughters to come back and live and work and raise their children in the same way that their mom did. So this is personal to us. It's urgent to us. And I think that the data takes the emotion out of it and really helps us create good policy practice and procedures. I love how department heads are going to be held responsible for having this as part of their strategic mission. I love what Eric has done to sort of unravel some of the old school antiquated practices around hiring. And I think that we have people like Ron constantly on our team and in our ear, offering advice and feedback and providing us a lot of information on the ground almost daily about the direction we need to go for our young people as well.
We're talking with Sean Rose, city councilor in Worcester, Eric Batista, the acting city manager, and Ron Waddell, executive director of Legendary Legacies, about how the city of Worcester is responding to a racial equity audit and demands from community to improve how the city government functions and issues of race and race equity in the city. Ron, I'll turn to you. I'm going to play a little bit of sound here from the Worcester NAACP president, Fred Taylor. This is him talking to Spectrum News One in response to the departure of the most recent of the three chief diversity officers who resigned.
Something is wrong. I don't know what the answer is and how we can fix it, but we need to fix it. And to fix it isn't to just put someone in that position and just hire someone new.
So, Ron, what's echoing in my head is trust, the need to rebuild trust inside a city government, between a city government and its people. And I'm also thinking about the racial tensions we've seen with City Council in Everett, the huge racial tensions we saw spill over in the Boston City Council. So there are lessons that Worcester, if it gets it right, could teach other cities and towns. How does trust get restored? Or am I wrong about trust being the issue, Ron?
I don't think that you're wrong in your assertion that trust could be improved. I think a theme throughout the report that I read was an opportunity for communication to be increased. When trust becomes an issue, it really is elevated by a culture or a position of lack of communication. And so I think the opportunity before us is really to open those channels and increase the communication between all stakeholders in which we could have equitable conversations. Now, to the end, I think the tension, the question you asked previously, can Worcester do it? And to Sean's point, we have to. But the tension is, what's the timeline? Mm-hmm. And so as a person of color raising two boys, being in the city and understanding the recognition well-deserved that Worcester has gotten as a national, if not international, destination. If that is the goal and the trajectory that we are trending on, then internally we do have to let go of some of these limited perceptions. And I'm known for saying that Worcester is a city, is Mayberry masquerading as a city. And so there are still some small town conversations and politics that take place when we are now positioning ourselves to be a national, if not international, city. And so to continue to move in that direction, it would be something that we have to do. But it's a matter of the timeline. How quickly can this happen? We know that within the report. And then as things change within elections, will the leadership and the continued support of such continue to remain? One thing that made me optimistic was the age demographics that we saw, close to 47% were 39 and under. And so with that, a different culture begins to come in as well. And so I think we can do it. I think the conversation and the opportunity for our city is to, how do we stay in the tension? How do we set that timeline? And I'm sure this is what Eric is and his team are really looking at as they approach this. But what is the timeline on how we do this?
All right. And by the way, Mayberry, Andy Griffith show, long time ago. All right. That's Ron Waddell.
I dated myself.
That, me too. That's Ron Waddell, Executive Director of Legendary Legacies, Sean Rose, City Councilor in Worcester, and Eric Batista, Acting City Manager for Worcester. Thanks to all three of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Two cars defaced in Stowe, a disturbing message left on a Stoneham lawn, racist flyers found in Chatham, hateful banners hung along a major highway in Saugus and Danvers. All examples of anti-Semitic actions recorded in the Commonwealth over the last few months. Nearly 300,000 Jewish people live in Massachusetts, one of the largest communities in the country. And today, we take stock of the impact on the youngest among them. With us now, Rabbi Orr Rose, who's founding director of the Betty Ann Greenbaum Miller Center for Interreligious Learning and Leadership at Hebrew College, and Rabbi Susie Jacobson, associate rabbi and education director at Temple Israel in Boston. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So a little bit of context. Nearly 400 incidents of hate, extremism, anti-Semitism, and terror attacks recorded so far this year in Massachusetts, according to the Anti-Defamation League of New England. For context, 10 years ago, zero of these types of incidents were recorded in Massachusetts, according to that same reporter. We have this on paper, but does this time feel different, Rabbi Rose?
Yes, I'm sad to say that this time period feels different, certainly than my own childhood and experiences as a youth. And in my interactions, not only with my adolescent children, but with youth from the Jewish community and in interreligious and cross-cultural contexts, this is very much on the hearts and minds of young people who are experiencing different forms of hate speech and action in their high schools and in their community clubs, etc.
So, Rabbi Susie Jacobson, we wanted to bring the two of you together to kind of reflect the full age range of our young people. So you start with kids before kindergarten.
Absolutely.
Right? And at what age are you finding that kids are becoming aware that they're in an environment that might be scary or threatening or hostile?
Some of our youngest students begin to ask questions when they notice that we have security guards outside of our synagogue.
And you have security guards.
We have security guards anytime there are kids in the building, anytime the program or the preschool is there. Even my four-year-old has asked me, why is Chris standing outside?
And when did that start? When did you start having security outside the building anytime you had children inside the building?
Many years ago. At least since 9/11, but since then, and any time there is a large anti-Semitic attack, as what happened in Pittsburgh, we've also had police presence, and the students come in and they come into their classrooms and they ask, "Why are they there? What is wrong?" And we have to explain to them, and we have to talk to them about what it means to be a Jew in this world today, and how it's our responsibility to do all we can to keep them safe, and to be honest with them about the threats in this world.
And Pittsburgh refers to the Tree of Life masculine.
Exactly.
So I'll turn back to you, Rabbi Orr. So now you have young people at college age, mm-hmm. at a level of formation where they're making a lot of choices about who they want to be as adults. And how do you think in that time of formation, how do you engage with young people who are aware of what's happening in the world around them and really processing it, both as young people and as adults who will go forward in this future and have the power to make change?
In speaking with Jewish youth and young adults specifically, one of the things that I say that may sound obvious is that anti-Semitism is not their fault, and it is not the fault of Jews. Just as other forms of hate speech and action that targets Muslims or other religious and cultural ethnic groups is not the fault of that group. And tragically, anti-Semitism is a very old and pernicious form of hate. And so they need to be aware that the world that they live in is both beautiful and broken. And then the question is how and when to speak out, how to protect themselves, how to engage with others in constructive conversation about their experiences, about the interconnection of different forms of hate speech and action, the ways in which we need to create allyship, and also to think about investing in long-term resilient relationships so that we are not mostly reacting to these flare-ups or to these ugly acts, but are consciously together creating an ethos of pluralism, religious, cultural, ethnic, etc.
So we're talking to Rabbi Or Rose, who's a founding director of the Betty Ann Greenbaum Miller Center for Interreligious Learning and Leadership at Hebrew College, and Rabbi Susie Jacobson, who's an associate rabbi and education director at Temple Israel in Boston. And we're looking at supporting young people from really young ages into their 20s in our communities as we see extreme increases in anti-Semitic action here. So, Rabbi Susie, bear with me. We were having a conversation with a pair of comedians last week, and we were talking about satire. Mm. And I said, you know, I talked about satire in the face of rising hate. And Bethany Van Delft, one of the comedians, said to me, oh, no. Not a rise in hate, a rise in expression of hate. And how do we talk with middle schoolers, right, about that piece of it and give them tools? Again, I am thinking about these developmental stages where what's happening is happening whether you're 3 or 13, but how you can handle it is so different based on where you are.
I think the most important thing as educators and rabbis is for us to understand that fear is an important part of the human experience and to be wise and careful listeners to our children, to allow them to express themselves, to share what they are feeling and what they are experiencing, and to make space for that. We are teaching a joyful Judaism, teaching them that Judaism is an incredible, life-giving, beautiful tradition, and the community is one of strength and power. We are not teaching a fearful, victimized sense of being Jewish in this world. And at the same time, the world is complicated. And we have to be there to listen to them and to hear them and to be with them in that. Recently, we gathered a group of teenagers and we were asking them, what is it like to be Jewish in your day school, in your public school? And all of them went around. And from the very first story, each of them told some story of anti-Semitism. And as grownups, we need to be there to allow them to share those stories, to process them together, to understand what's happening in this world. Because they are seeing things that I did not see growing up. And it's hard for some of us. I grew up with the myth that Jews are doing better, that progress is an upward slope, and that the world that my grandparents lived in is not the world that I live in. And yet, here we are, where our children and our students are experiencing anti-Semitism in violence, in speech, in swastikas carved on lockers, and we need to be present with them in that as we give them tools to learn how to cope.
So, Rabbi Or, I'm going to carve something out here, right? So, you are dealing with high school students, college students, where their awareness of the world, what you're teaching them about the world, is a key piece of what you're doing as an educator. Our focus today is the kind of hate and anti-Semitism that has no justification and no explanation. I want to say that because I know there will be listeners who say, well, there's a whole set of politics and policy around here that you must be teaching at Hebrew College around geopolitical issues, sovereignty, oppression, et cetera, that play into this. I want to mark that and say there is a conversation there. It's not the one that we're having today. So let me do that so that I can ask you the next question, which is how you are educating people at school, young people at school, Are the lessons plans changing? Are the curriculum changing in, say, you know, 10 years ago to now when it comes to learning how to deal with hate, especially when you're training potential rabbis?
Yes, both in terms of content, but also in terms of form. We know, for example, that social media is so important to the lives of younger generations. And I want to say that, like all technological advancements, social media is a tool which can be used and is used regularly for the democratization of knowledge, for furthering free speech, and it can and is used for the articulation of unfettered animosity, bigotry, and hatred. So one area is education vis-a-vis social media. What does it mean to create a social media presence? When do you speak? How do you speak? With whom do you speak? We also try, like all educators, to think about time-worn lessons of history and also what is happening here and now. So what can we learn from this political figure or that athlete? And what did they say? Why did they say it? What information do they have? How can we articulate an intelligent, thoughtful, strong, and compassionate response when people make mistakes? But how do we do all of that in a way that also articulates what Rabbi Susi said a moment ago? We are proud to be bearers of this Jewish tradition. There is so much light and beauty. And at the same time, we have to face the ugliness that is a part of human existence.
I want to pick up on that with you, Susi Jacobson, in working as education director at Temple Israel in Boston. That's okay. We just had a water spill. This is live radio, folks.
It's Mazel tov.
Good. Nice. Nice. So we do have prominent athletes, entertainment figures, politicians, increasingly expressing anti-Semitic views on social media. Kids are the earliest adopters now of social media. They are social media natives in a way that those who are educating them can't be and aren't. How do you help them learn how to navigate that space, learn how to navigate a space that can feel hostile, and learn how to not hate themselves?
It's an incredibly important conversation. I think in addition to what Orda said, we also need to talk to them about the anti-Semitic tropes and memes and ideas that are out there to help them understand them. We've had situations where kids have come into our educational spaces and have parroted back such anti-Semitic tropes as Jews are in charge of the media and argue with us that aren't we in charge of the media? And we have to teach them and help them understand the history of that idea and help them see and understand, because so much of it becomes internalized. I also think that there are things on the internet that they don't understand. There are certain shorthand or memes or other ideas that get passed, and they don't realize why it's anti-Semitic or why certain images are anti-Semitic. So we have honest conversations with our teens and with our middle schoolers and even younger about what they're seeing to help them process that.
So, Rabbi Orr, we have a little more than 30 seconds left. Mm. Is there also an opportunity here to build solidarity?
Absolutely.
Because our Jewish residents here in Massachusetts are not the only ones experiencing hate.
Yes. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said that we are a part of an inescapable garment of mutuality. And so we need to come to understand that our diversity is our strength, and that one form of hate speech or action targeting a particular group is the beginning and not the end of pain and suffering for many other people. And so the question is, can we form bonds and bridges? And as a colleague of mine from Interfaith America in Chicago, Eboo Patel, says, bridges must be built. They don't fall from the sky. And so between flare-ups and incidents, we must do the work of bridge building.
That was Rabbi Orr Rose, founding director of the Betty Ann Greenbaum Miller Center for Interreligious Learning and Leadership at Hebrew College. Also with us, Rabbi Susi Jacobson, associate rabbi and education director at Temple Israel in Boston. Thank you to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just a note, a vigil will be held in Stowe tonight to condemn the recent act of anti-Semitism there. Reports show it's set to begin around sunset. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And what you're hearing right now is a brand new instrument, the Renaissance 17. It is a digital microtonal keyboard with 17 keys per octave, which is five more than the usual 12 keys per octave. And it was conceived of and designed by Mehmet Ali Sanlıkol, Grammy-nominated musician, composer, faculty member at New England Conservatory, and friend of the show. Mehmet joined us in Studio 2 to talk about the Sanlıkol Renaissance 17, and he started by talking about the piece you're hearing right now.
I came up with a particular way to tune the instrument, and so that I could play a Turkish mode, a Turkish makam on it, which are, just by nature of the music, are microtonal scales, if you will.
So let's talk about this microtonal thing, which we've talked about with you before. Mm-hmm. My understanding is this is what made you decide to invent a new instrument.
Yes, it's essentially, it is, from a Western perspective, it is those notes that are not necessarily found on a contemporary guitar or a contemporary piano or keyboard instruments that have 12 notes per octave. But where I come from, in Turkey, in the Middle East, in different parts of the world, there are musics that are performed, traditional musics that are performed, are typically, quote-unquote, microtonal, meaning they have more than 12 pitches per octave.
So we wanted to break this down for listeners because we'll have some who want to appreciate what you're saying but don't know music at all. Mm-hmm. So we've got two pieces of sound here. First, this typical Western 12-note octave. Here's what it sounds like on a piano.
C, C sharp, D, D sharp, E, F, F sharp, G, G sharp, A sharp, and B.
And of course, if you take out the sharps, what you have is Julie Andrews and Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do, basically.
That's right. That's right.
All right, now here is an octave on the R17. And those extra little notes, they almost make me lift out of my seat a little bit. It's just lifting. And that's what you mean by micro.
That's right.
And microtonal, right?
Right. I mean, and I do want to make it clear to everyone listening that in different parts of the world, of course, people don't think of those notes as micro. You know, they think of them as just different flavors of different pitches.
So the other thing that I learned from your demonstration video, we'll call it on YouTube, is you talk about the fact that it's not that there aren't other instruments that use what we're calling microtonal tones, but that you've designed something that looks and feels very much like an organ or a piano keyboard. And so one's hands, if one's already experienced with a 12-note key instrument from Western culture, can find your way around on those keys. Is that right?
That's true. And the fact that the instrument was actually conceived based on historical European instruments is part of the reason as to why I called it the Renaissance 17. Because most people in Europe or the United States don't really know that, in fact, back in the late Renaissance and early Baroque, there were these kinds of instruments with more than 12 keys per octave. And basically, I was exposed to such historical instruments when I was a master's student at New England Conservatory 23 years ago. It was the late faculty member, well-known composer Dan Pinkham, that took all of us, our class, to an organ room and started playing this instrument that not only had these so-called split keys, like the Renaissance 17, like my instrument, but it was an actual organ. And the tuning of it was, again, microtonal.
So we've got a little bit of you playing a Baroque piece. It was composed by Gregorio Strozzi, and it was actually composed for instruments that would have more than 12 keys per octave.
Exactly.
used to a narrative of the future means more and technology means more. But that was common in the 1500s, and somehow we, at least in the West, shrank, right? So how did we get to away from that into the standard 12 keys?
Well, we shrank in one way, and then we expanded another. The orchestra grew in size. And while that was happening, we needed to come up with some sort of a standard for all of these different instruments to be able to play together. The concept of, you know, referring to an alto saxophone as an E-flat instrument, you know, a tenor saxophone, a B-flat
which
instrument.
Which are called different keys.
That's right. Meaning, in the past, to negotiate those differences were more difficult, especially because of these microtonal qualities.
I see.
So you needed a standard so that these, you know, a large orchestra, a large ensemble could play together with a least amount of problems. Whereas, for example, in the Middle East, it was the opposite. These kinds of microtonal flavors ended up actually expanding more over the course of centuries.
We're speaking with Mehmet Ali Sanlıkol, who's a faculty member at New England Conservatory, Grammy-nominated musician, and now inventor, creator, you pick the word, of the Renaissance 17, which is a new microtonal instrument. I mean, you made a new instrument. And I want to back up for a minute, because we had you on the show. You had released a new album, and it was really innovative marrying of traditional Turkish music, Middle Eastern music, and jazz. And when I heard you had made this Renaissance 17, I thought, I wonder if there were just no instruments to keep up with his imagination anymore.
Well, I came up with this idea as a naive dream of a thought 23 years ago first. So I always had this in my mind. It's just that I did not necessarily have the courage to be able to launch such a project. But 4 years ago, I finally thought that maybe I could get a grant. And the Boston Foundation's lab grant actually gave me this opportunity to be able to fund the building of this instrument. And it was difficult. It was a very difficult process, but we managed. Here it is, fully functional. It is a prototype, but it certainly allows me to be able to dive into this world, which I was not able to tap into musically as much before.
As much as you wanted to.
Yes.
So picking up on that, we're going to hear some more music here. Mm-hmm. Another improvisational piece from your demonstration video unveiling the Renaissance 17. Now, this is an electronic instrument. When I saw the demonstration, the prototype looks very much like a wooden piano almost, with double beautiful, you know, when you can see the grain of the wood?
Yes.
Double keys with the grain of the
exactly.
wood, and
yeah,
the white
yeah.
keys are black keys.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I kept thinking, what's in the box, right? Is it a hammer hitting strings and you have more hammers? Is it the guts of a computer in there? What's in there to make this music?
Right. So when I first started launching this project, I approached a number of people and I spoke to engineers at Stanford and MIT. And a lot of the people, to my surprise, said that, well, you know, to build a keyboard is going to be difficult for us. You know, you don't want to go with 3D printing and so on and so forth because the action is not going to be right, et cetera.
The action means the response of the key to your fingertip.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. And so they all recommended that I go find a professional luthier who builds harpsichords or organs.
And luthiers are crafters of musical instruments.
That's right. And so New England area is actually famous for early music experts. And so lots of luthiers who build harpsichords and organs actually happen to be situated in this area. So it wasn't all that easy to find one that would accept to launch this project, because they don't typically build 17 keyboards every, you know, all the time. But there was Jacob Kaiser, who's based in New London, Connecticut, and he said, yes, I can do it. And he first sent a diagram, a picture of what he was going to do, and then he built the 17-key keyboard. And then I first worked with an engineer from MIT Media Lab, and the first trial basically failed. mainly because the first engineer tried to put in an electronic system that was very different from the kinds of MIDI keyboards that are out there today. Just a regular MIDI keyboard that you can go and buy from Guitar Center.
And MIDI has something to do with it being able to connect to a computer, right?
That's right. After all, the idea, the very fundamental idea here was, why don't we build a digital instrument with all of the sharps, flats, split, but at the same time, because it's digital, I can change tuning of the instrument from this piece to that piece with the hit of a button. And I can use many different kinds of sounds, ranging from an electric piano to, you know, all kinds of different possibilities, organs, synthesizers, etc. That was the basic idea. And so the second engineer I worked with, Sage Radachowski, he was actually able to devise a system where inside the keyboard at the end of the keys, there are basically brass springs that create connection with the circuit board. And
so it works a lot like a piano would, actually,
kind
or a
of.
Harpsichord.
Yeah,
or a...
yeah, yeah. It is similar. It is. It's something in
it's
between.
It's both.
Yeah. And
both.
Again, this is the prototype. This is a prototype. It took 2.5 years to get to this point. And I'm still scared to put it in the back of my car and take it from one place to another, you know.
But Boston potholes.
But, you know, we are, we're of course, there is constant improvement that is being done to the instrument to make it more solid. And, I mean, just the other day, I took it to another place and I took it out of the car and it worked. You know, it works.
Are there already people who want to play it?
Yes. Online, a couple of people started responding and asking about it. That's a big question. I know that I'm a composer. I'm a musician. I dreamt this instrument up only because I wanted to play it and I wanted to make music with it. You know, I wasn't necessarily looking to launch a line, a production line of the Sonla called Renaissance 17, but who knows what may happen in the future.
So I want to marry this idea of you wanted to make music with it, with the idea we talked about earlier of your imagination for 23 years of having something else be possible in your music. One of the places you've taken this prototype in your car was to Jordan Hall at the New England Conservatory back in September. You played a concert there. I want to hear that music. Okay, so I love it because one of the things that really struck us about it was when you really go to town on the R17. And as we heard that piece, you were just playing it on the table here, not the actual instrument, but you were fingering it back out. There are so many questions I want to talk about from here. But part one, This is what you are known for, right? Which is blending Turkish music, Middle Eastern music, with jazz. And this is that, isn't it?
This is really that, yes. This particular piece we're listening to is just that. It is taking the spirit of jazz and also trying to bring in the makam without sacrificing it in any way, honoring the tradition of makam as fully as I could. To render that tradition precisely isn't all that easy. And so it was always in the past, on the keyboard at least, in some way negotiating things. But with the Renaissance 17, I don't really have to negotiate things.
So that's the second question, right? Yeah. This negotiating. I'm glad you used that term because what I thought about in hearing you was, well, does this unlock a corner of your imagination that was holding back because of what was physically possible before?
Right. In a way, it is. At least in this setting, you know, it allows me to be able to go a longer distance. But in the end, you know, just to make something clear, when I find myself, you know, commissioned to compose for orchestra, you know, then I change perception and I say to myself, how can I find other ways of still, you know, communicating the spirit of this music while I may have to negotiate things, you know, because this is a complex matter. Of course, this instrument, again, I had it in mind for so long, and finally I'm discovering things that I just was not able to tap into musically before. There's no question about that. But music is such a big world of different colors and different possibilities. And so in this kind of world of experiments and so on and so forth, it's more about being mature and thinking about how can I communicate the very essence of this music while honoring both of these traditions that I'm trying to bring together, you know, fully.
All right, so I want to play a little bit more here. Mm-hmm. So in this piece, which is from the concert at Jordan Hall in September, you are improvising vocally and on the R17 at the same time. So that is almost like scatting and playing traditional Turkish music at the same time. So, okay, here's what I think I've learned about improvisation. That, you know, the first stage is you just learn the instrument, so you know what it can do. The second stage is that you learn, you imagine something and you eventually learn how to play it on that instrument. The third stage is that you can play it on the instrument as you're imagining it.
Good.
Okay, you've now done a fourth stage, which is play it on the instrument and sing it at the same time that you're imagining it. It's a new instrument.
Right.
So how to get to that master stage so fast?
Well, first of all, the makam, you know, the modality itself is inside my head anyway. I've had it for a long time. I've internalized that musical language and therefore that particular modality for God knows how long. Same goes for the language of jazz. And so I'm bilingual, both musically and linguistically. So in this case, because I'm bi-musical, so I'm able to play this. Yes, the instrument may be new, but what I'm playing on it is something that I had in me for a long time. In fact, the instrument just helps me put it out there.
So what's possible for you next? And did you ever think? No, you did. 23 years ago, you did.
I did.
What's possible for you now?
Well, I mean, I've just started unlocking the possibilities of new pieces composed for this instrument, performed by this instrument in the trio setting, in the large ensemble setting. I do want to put it in the jazz orchestra setting, in the orchestra setting, as a featured soloist. And so in order to get there, I need to first get the instrument to become a little bit more solid. The mechanism needs to be solidified a little bit more so that I'm not as scared as carrying it in the back of my car. but you know, I don't think that's going to take too long. We're already making progress. And then I think it'll be, tapping into these new worlds and seeing what I have to negotiate next. Because I'll be putting it in the context of the large ensemble.
That's Mehmet Ali Senlikol, Grammy-nominated musician, composer, and now inventor of the Senlikol Renaissance 17. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.